This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zelinsky.
G'day, welcome to Diplomates. I'm Misha Zelinsky. This week I caught up with Ambassador Frank Lavin. Frank Lavin has been a fixture in Republican politics for the last 40 years. He worked for President Reagan as his head of politics, advised George H.W. Bush, and under George W. Bush, he was appointed U.S. Ambassador to Singapore. He's a prolific author for global publications, and Frank had a second career in Asian finance, is now CEO and founder of Export Now. A prominent never-Trumper, Frank's been a vocal critic of the Donald Trump administration. I caught up with Frank for a chinwag about election 2020 and whether Donald Trump can fight back and win, why elections are defined by what voters don't want, what made Ronald Reagan the politician of his era, how politics has changed for the worse today, the future of the Republican Party, the secret to winning presidential races, and what the rise of an authoritarian China means for the US, Australia, and the world. It's a big and wide-ranging chat, and we had a lot of fun. I should also say that Frank absolutely wins the award for best barbecue answer in the history of the show, and once you hear it, I'm sure you'll agree with me. Also, if you aren't following the show yet on Instagram and Twitter, check out the show notes, or it's at Diplomate Show or at Misha Zelinsky. Jump on Twitter and Instagram. I am enjoying all the interactions on there, so keep sending me your questions and comments. At the end of the episode, stay listening as I've answered one question from a listener, as I said I would last week, and if anyone wants to shoot one through to me after this episode, I'm happy to read it out on air. And remember, five-star reviews are appreciated. Now, let's hear the episode. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks, Misha. Glad to be here.
And thank you so much for joining us on Diplomates this week. Now, you are in Singapore for the audio tape.
I am locked down in Singapore. My business is actually in Shanghai, but I bunk in Singapore because that's where my wife works. And so it so happened when the curtain came down on coronavirus, was locked down here. And here I've been for about the last 6 or 7 months.
Yeah, right. It's a tough time everywhere at the moment. So, and no doubt we'll cover Corona, but there's so many things I'd like to talk to you about in terms of your personal very long career in politics. But given that we are now very near to the US presidential election, and clearly that's what everyone's tuning in for, I thought we might start with the election. And you wrote a piece recently. I thought we could start here. You wrote a piece recently saying, "Don't really focus on what voters want. Focus on what they don't want." What did you mean by that? And what does that mean for the election?
You know, I think this is a global phenomenon. When we have a public discussion and we articulate our preferences, we typically do so in terms of upside and aspirations. Where do we want our country to go? What kind of political leadership do we want? So that's typically the currency of public discussion. However, in decision-making theory, it's very different than that. It's people vote their fears, they vote negative, they vote against, they can identify the greatest threat or the greatest risk, and that's what they vote against. And I don't think it's any coincidence to take examples from this cycle, Misha. I think we can make a pretty strong case that of the rather crowded Democratic field this time, Joe Biden was the least flawed candidate. He was the person who you had a hard time voting against if you were a Democrat. But there are other people all had different sort of flaws, personal flaws, ideological flaws, and so forth that made them weak and turned, I think, a lot of Democrats away from them. And I think also Kamala Harris, of the candidates mentioned for running mate, that she was the least flawed running mate. So they ended up with a package that is broadly acceptable to Democrats, rank and file, that if you typically vote Democratic, you're going to be very comfortable voting for Biden and Harris.
And so the state of the race, I mean, it's been pretty set for some time now, you know, polling, and I think it has a lot of people nervous because of what happened in 2016. But if you believe the polling, Biden's ahead nationally considerably. He's ahead in most of the battleground states, the key states. I mean, firstly, do you think that's the state of the race? And then secondly, I mean, can Trump come from behind, you know, with only, you know, a number of weeks left?
Yeah, look, I think a race with an incumbent in it is overwhelmingly a referendum on that incumbent. So what the polls are telling us, and I do think they're accurate, is voters would prefer someone other than Trump. That Trump has already sort of lost the job interview. He's already sort of failed the job interview. It's not 100% clear if Biden has won pass the job interview, but they've already sort of decided they don't want to renew Trump's lease for another 4 years. And no surprise that the poll numbers are stable. Trump is a known quantity, Biden's a known quantity. So it's not as if you're going to discover something new about Donald Trump in the next 30 days that might change your mind. I think it's going to tighten up a little bit. I think Trump has a better chance to improve his standing than Biden does, meaning I think Biden's more or less at his ceiling of around 50%, but Trump is underperforming, I think, a bit at about 42%. So I think Trump can go up a point or two, but I think he has trouble going beyond that. So I would still, subject to, you know, the one big question mark that's left in these last 6 weeks, Misha, is the three presidential debates. So subject to something egregious taking place in those debates, of sort of normal performance, more or less a draw, I think Biden wins, and I think he ends up winning by about 4 points or so.
And so, I mean, the other big thing underway now, and, you know, it's crazy to think of all the things that have happened in this term. We had an impeachment, which seems to is not going to be even a factor in this election, though whether or not it's perhaps baked into Trump's numbers. You've got the Supreme Court nomination situation. Do you think, you know, the replacement of RBG, do you think there's going to be a factor, or does it net out both sides? Is it a positive for the Democrats in the suburbs? How do you see that playing out as an election issue? And then we might even...
Well, I'll give you sort of a political science answer, meaning I do think it nets out even in that passion on both sides is even. But I think that phenomenon plays to the advantage of the front runner, because the you've got a front runner, as you point out, is in a rather static position, 6-8 points up. There's only 42 days left. And if you're going to eat up 5 or 10 of those days with Senate hearings, you're absorbing the news. The insurgent or the underdog doesn't have the opportunity to make his case. So if Biden can run out the clock a bit, I think this helps him at the margin. It just takes Trump off message, and it doesn't help him close the gap at all.
And so we talked about campaigns. I mean, you're a veteran of many Republican campaigns over a very long number of years. Debates, you know, there's always a lot of focus on them. Do you think they matter at all? And then, like, you know, I mean, what would you be looking for as a Republican strategist at the three debates? You sort of said, look, if it's a draw, it won't matter. But what makes a draw, firstly? And then secondly, yeah, do they matter at all in the context of a long electoral cycle and campaign?
I would score these debates. I think they do matter, but the metric, it's easy to have the wrong metric. Meaning the wrong metric here is an academic debate scorecard where you're, you know, a typical academic debate, should Britain go ahead with Brexit or something, and it's the, you know, Oxford Society has this debate, and the judges vote, you know, 82-77 that the affirmative side won. That's the wrong way of doing it. Because, look, somebody is going to do marginally better than the other person on points. But what I'm saying is that aspect of the debate I don't think matters much. I think look at the debate as a threshold set of performance questions, meaning did each candidate perform adequately? Did they perform to the moment? Were they more or less in their game, on their game, spoke to their constituency, spoke to the issue, stayed on message, were more or less disciplined in messaging, no egregious faults or failures? If they basically do an adequate job, then it's a tie, it's a wash. And meaning I think Biden supporters simply want to be reassured that their candidate is okay, and Trump voters the same. But the stakes are a little higher for Biden. Trump has chosen over the last 6 months to make Biden's age a bit of an issue. And so there'll be some scrutiny on that point. But if you watch the Democratic primary debate, Biden did fine. Biden certainly passed any kind of threshold criteria. And if you watch, there's a recent, we call these town hall meetings, recent sort of open question format on, I think, one of the networks, the US ABC. And again, Biden did fine. It wasn't a, you know, these are sort of man on the street questions, so they're not exactly hardball questions. But he had no gaps, no gaffes, no, you know, he did perfectly fine on these questions. So I think the rap that he somehow, you know, drifting or not up to it or not engaged, I think I don't see any evidence of that, right? But God forbid, from the Biden perspective, if he does loses his train of thought or has a gap in something, he will pay a price for that.
Do you think, though, it's somewhat ironic, do you think that perhaps Trump has misplayed this in that he's lowered the threshold of success for Biden. He's managed his expectations down so much that if Joe turns up and is basically, coherent to your point, that's a tick.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And also, I think there's an element of Biden's stage presence that has a bit of charm to it, meaning the guy is loquacious, but that's very different than saying he's senile. I mean, the guy overtalks issues and he has odd verbal tics, but a lot of people in public life, so he'll use a stock phrase like, come on, man, to enforce a point, which is, you know, you could say rhetorically weak, but it has a certain amount of everyman charm to it, right? It's not pretentious. He's not quoting Latin. He is an authentic person. He is a man of the street. So I think, you know, wrapping him for that doesn't help Trump. He also uses the sort of the invective at the end of some sentences, I'm serious, you know, which again is a painfully weak rhetorical device, but it is authentic. It is Joe Biden, you know, and if you don't believe this guy is the major party nominee, front runner for president, that he's serious when he makes a point, there's nothing, the least effective way of convincing you he's serious is to say, I'm serious. So he's not a rhetorical master, but again, there's a certain charm in the everyday or unpretentiousness of his approach.
And so, you know, stepping out to the campaigns more generally, how do you see campaigning today as being different to where campaigns have been traditionally run? I mean, is there a difference? I mean, one of the big things people talk about is that so much is focused now on turning out your own vote, turning out your base vote rather than persuasion of undecided voters. But how do you see campaigns today compared to, you know, the way they've been run over the last?
Well, there's been a few shifts in my short political life, but in the last few decades, I mean, one shift has been the prevalence of digital communications means we're rewarding depth rather than breadth. We're rewarding people who might own an issue or a segment of an issue rather than rewarding somebody who can get 51%. So pugnacity is important. You've got the most cluttered media environment in the world, and you have to break through that. So there's always a temptation to say something outrageous or be outrageous. And I mean, Trump is a very good example of that. I think you'd say, if you ask Trump, what are the rules of communication? He'd say rule number one is never be dull. And that Trump boy, Trump owns that segment of the population of people.
He doesn't breach that rule.
Right. And there's a certain segment, you know, call it the WWF segment that says, I can't necessarily follow the issues or follow the policies, but I can tell who the most combative person is, and I warm to that person. And I think I want a fighter, so the person who uses the toughest rhetoric has my vote. I think, by the way, I think you pay a price for that in all sorts of ways as well, but you can see that Trump captures some advantage out of just sort of tone and temperament. So there's been a drift toward that kind of fragmentation of the market. There's been a reward toward pugnacity. And at the same token, I'd say, with some regret, there's been a real shift away from management expertise, that we want someone who can actually run a government program or run a solution or find the best way. So if we have, you know, if we have problems with high school dropouts, we want someone who's sort of the most emotional about that issue, not the one who says, I have 7-point plan to reduce high school dropouts. Here's some ideas that will work to reduce high school dropouts. So there's been a real deterioration in the dynamic for somebody who's got management expertise. And I'd say by the same token, it seems every single cycle we strip out the one remaining element of the process that would reward some kind of political leadership to say, you know, make it have some elements of a parliamentary system. The last time that was done was Democrats stripped out largely the value of the so-called superdelegates, where they had a somewhat of a parliamentary element to their process, where they said, we're going to let sitting members of Congress and governors and senators each have a vote. And then they said later, no, we're just sort of kidding about that. We don't want that. And that was a concession that Hillary Clinton had to make to the Bernie Sanders group, because obviously those people would look at Bernie Sanders was anathema, and he said sort of for his loyalty, you have to kind of dilute that group's power. So we're into a point now where it's pure vote with no intermediating institution or individual. So that rewards that emotional content, that rewards that communication skill, and it really devalues both management and sort of leadership or resume. I mean, it's very interesting to me that, you know, the last two presidents were two President Biden, I'm sorry, Trump and Obama were two presidents, had very strong communication skills. Both of them loved the rally format, large scale, large mass, very strong emotional connectivity with the base, and neither of them, you know, ran on the basis of a government record. Presumably, Obama's the only one who could have, but he'd been in the Senate for 2 years. There was no Obama bill or no Obama history, and he knew that. He said, what I can do better than anybody else is communicate and form that emotional bond, and he did it very effectively. So we're in an era now where that sort of populism, I think, dominates the process, and saying I'm the master of the Senate, I'm Lyndon Johnson, and I orchestrated 40 pieces of legislation, and I'm sort of moving America in a certain way. We said that doesn't really matter anymore, or doesn't matter the way it used to. Right? So that's a huge shift, I think, in electorate behavior in the last few decades.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when you look at, perhaps if you look at the Democrat primary, the governors, who all have presumably a good, to your point, government experience, have got records, have not done well at all, and they didn't even get it through to Iowa. Whereas you look back to, say, Bill Clinton in '92, I mean, he was governor of Arkansas, and that was a good base for him to campaign. So, interesting point you raised. But also, I mean, so do you think that the lack of gatekeepers in major parties is a problem now, the so-called smoky back rooms, in terms of...
I think we'd be better off with them playing some kind of role. I mean, there should be some median where, look, I'm fundamentally, I believe in democracy, so you want the voters to elect delegates, the delegates to elect. But I thought an idea of the super delegates or something like that made a lot of sense to say, look, this person who's a member of Congress or senator, governor has some awareness of the system and some capability to add to the conversation. So I wouldn't just simply discount that to zero. So I think that's the happy medium, that voters can directly elect any delegate they want for any reason they want, but the incumbent members, those few hundred other people, are going to have their say as well. So then you have a sort of bicameral process. A little bit like the UK Labour Party, right, where they have direct membership, and they also have union leadership vote. Everybody, different constituencies have different rights within the UK Labour Party.
Yeah, that's right. In Australia as well, it's the leadership of the Labour Party is now decided 50% vote of the rank and file membership, 50% by the union caucus, the colleagues of the candidates. So, and they know them best, presumably, right? So they know what they're like.
That's in a member's constituency. What you just described.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like 50-50 college. Members of the Labor Party get a vote directly, and then the other half of the vote is made up by people that are in the federal parliamentary caucus along with the candidates.
Good. Well, it's not for me to tell Australia what to do, but I'd say that's some kind of balance that lets leadership play a role, but also lets, rank and file of the man on the street play a role would be helpful. And, interestingly, of the leading candidates this cycle, two of them were not members of their party in any meaningful sense, meaning Bernie Sanders was never a Democrat and Donald Trump was never a Republican. So it's just extraordinary to me. You can sort of walk in off the street and through self-declaration just sort of say, this looks interesting to me, why don't I lead this party? And say, my, that's a rather elastic political structure. If somebody could just knock on the door. Biden, to his credit, has been a registered Democrat, active Democrat for 40, 50 years. So he's a life that's a much more traditional biography of the people we used to nominate.
It's essentially been a hostile takeover of the Republican Party by Trump, and an attempted one by Sanders. And you're right. I often remark to people, that friends of mine that are Sanders people, who say, the Democratic Party was very unfair to Bernie. I said, well, he's not a member. So you can understand there might be some hostility from an organization that someone is not a member of to being sort of colonized by. But, that's just that's an observation. Yeah. But now, going right back to, I want to zero in now on your experience. And we've talked a lot about the Republican Party. You were, of course, Ronald Reagan's political director. So, you know, way back when, legendary Republican president, sort of the beginning of the modern era in many ways. Actually, before we get into your experiences there, I mean, what was Ronald Reagan like as a person and a man and a president? I'm kind of curious for your take on that.
Yeah, well, if I had picked one word, I'd say genial, meaning I think an element of leadership is to project an amiability and to be open to anybody's opinions, questions, and to say, look, it's a world of opinions. Everybody's got an opinion. Everybody wants a hearing. They view the president as some sort of Supreme Court type figure that they say, I want, you know, this, I've got this injustice. I've got this problem. You need to fix, you need to help it. So you need to have that in your mind when you take the job, that you're going to have a lot of people knocking on the door and coming in, and you better be able to treat them with respect and with kindness and give everybody a good hearing. So he was extremely good at that. And I suspect that came from a long history in movies, TV, and radio, where, again, you're a public figure and Americans are just unabashed about approaching people and saying to Ronald Reagan, the actor, you know, my cat just died and I had named him Ronald after you. I'd like you to come to my cat's funeral. I mean, but Americans will say things like that, and you have to be able to say something gracious, you know, and polite to that person, not, you know, get out of my way, you lunatic. So Reagan was very, very good at offering empathy and trying to be compassionate with somebody and trying to, you know, give the person the time of day and make sure the person is taken care of. And he was a great guy to work with as well. No static, no sharp elbows. I think he also, just as a human being, as a manager, you know, if you have all the power in the world, you can be gracious, you can be kind. And the saying of that as 1980s was, of all the different kind of people who end up in the West Wing, some of them quite difficult personalities, the two nicest people in the West Wing were Ronald Reagan and George Bush. And they're both sort of old school gentlemen who were just very, very polite. I have great guys to work with, and you could say anything to them, they'd respond. I mean, very approachable. So I enjoyed that time with Reagan and with Bush.
So, I mean, let's talk about, you know, Reagan and Bush. I mean, a lot of people talk today, they talk about President Trump, and essentially he appears he can't take bad advice. And essentially anyone that stood up to him or had a different view has been essentially run out of the White House. How did the White Houses operate under Presidents Reagan and Bush? I mean, and how would you give advice to the president? It might be contrary to what they're thinking at the time.
Well, but that happens regularly, I think, in a professionally managed organization. You set a tone from the top that you know, we're trying to go in a certain direction, trying to go in a certain path, but we want to hear about the trade-offs, we want to hear about the costs, we want to hear about alternative paths. And that's part of the policy process. And that's why you have I was on the National Security Council's staff, but that's why you have that NSC process to say, you know, we're all concerned about problem X and there are three or four options in front of us. And let's look at the costs and benefits of these different approaches and have a thoughtful discussion. So there was never a climate of sort of hostility or, you know, stigmatizing the outlier. You wanted to always make sure you heard the outlier. As I said, let's make sure around the table there's at least one negative voice there so we fully understand what might go wrong and we don't get into an odd kind of cheerleading dynamic of, you know, we run cheering down some path because we're just reinforcing each other's worst instincts. So I thought Reagan and Bush were both good managers in that respect. I think you're right, Trump is not, doesn't have a lot of policy depth, so we can't always evaluate the trade-offs. And then you overlay that with enormous personal sensitivities. So if you challenge him, it's a personal slight, and he thinks you're impugning him. So he must rebuff you. He must knock you down or swat you down. So you only sort of learn by doing, and sometimes you don't learn at all. Right. And the good thing about Trump, good thing about Reagan, I would say, and Bush as well, is they each had a policy compass. They each knew where they wanted to go. And they'd also spent a considerable time in public life. So they had a team. They had people they worked with, people they trusted, people believed in them, had working responsibilities. So they didn't just wash up on the shores of the White House election day and say, let's try to figure this out. They had been at this search and at this business of government for decades, right? And so reasonably well seasoned when they came into office, Trump really suffers from the fact that he, you know, it's kind of impressive he won, but he won as the outsider and as the contrarian with any kind of government background at all. And you play a price for that because he didn't have a team. He didn't have thought through position papers when he came into office.
Now, you know, the Reagan era, the Bush one era, you know, the '80s into the early '90s. I mean, politics has always been not a game for the fearful, and so it's always been very robustly contested in the United States. But you know, it strikes me, and certainly Biden talks about this a lot. It strikes me that politics has gotten nastier in recent times, and certainly nastier since that era. Would you agree with that? And like, you know, how did things happen in the back rooms? And when you'd be talking to the other side compared to what you observe today?
I think there's been enormous deterioration, and I, you know, you hate to lay it all at one person, but I've never seen a president act the way Trump acts with regard to how he describes political adversaries or impugns them. But to have that kind of raw criticism or mocking or scorn of individuals and opponents from a presidential statement, I think is beneath the office. I think you all, but I would say one of the first rules of serving as president is to act like a president, to act with a degree of dignity. And if you, you know, if you want to sort of take a shot at someone, we see presidents do that. You know, you can use humor. You can use sort of backhanded or understated glances. People get the joke. People know what you're saying. But to simply berate somebody and denigrate someone is, I think, appalling. And then he frequently does it in a context of their ethnicity or their religion or where they're from. I mean, I think these are just appalling statements that nobody in public life should act that way.
And so the Republican Party, you know, you're a longtime Republican. You know, you got links right back to, you know, Reagan, Bush and George W. Bush. You know, I'm kind of curious about how the Republican Party has changed, because I often think, you know, you look at Ronald Reagan's record as, and he's considered to be the gold standard, I think, often by many Republicans active today. But you look at his record as Californian governor and you think, would he win a primary in 2020?
Yeah.
And so what does that say about the modern Republican Party from your point?
Well, but I think there are two or three things going on here. One of which we talked about, which is the rise of digital media and the rise of sort of emotional populism and this populist. I mean, what is populism? When we say one, we discussed already, is emotional connectivity rather than sort of a managerial approach to problems. Now, that can be on the left or the right. But another element of populism, I would say, is it's grievance based. You know, tell me what's wrong. Tell me what you don't like and I'll speak to your grievances, which, you know, on the one hand, all grievances need an airing. But on the other hand, if your messaging is entirely grievance oriented, you're not talking about solutions and you're not allowing people to feel comfortable about the direction of the country. So there's the price you pay for being grievance. I'd say a third area of populism, which is also a bit dangerous or a bit risky, is populism's message is exculpatory. Populism's message is the problems we face today are because others have done this to us. But I would say in most countries, it's generally pretty much the opposite. The problems, you know, the problems Australia faces today are problems that Australians have made. The problems that Americans face today are problems Americans have made, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, if you have a problem with drug use or high school dropouts or street crime or unemployment or lack of sort of racial equality, those are self-inflicted problems. Those weren't problems that, you know, Japanese or Chinese steelmakers foisted upon us. So it's a bit, you can see the seduction of it, but there's a bit of a danger in that if you're telling people our problems are caused by someone else, instead of saying, I want to bring a mirror and I want you to look in this mirror and tell us what we're doing wrong. And I'll tell you the fourth element of populism, I would say, is policy choices have no trade-offs, right? We're going down the wrong path, but don't worry, I'm going to take us down the right path. But we know in government, almost all policy choices do have a trade-off. And you can be unhappy with the path we're on, there are advantages and disadvantages, but the alternative one you're suggesting is also going to have cost and benefit. So it's not a question of right and wrong, but if you listen to a lot of the Trump rhetoric, and I would say some of the Obama rhetoric. Obama had a populist streak, but I don't think he was as orthodox populist as Trump. But he could have elements of that as well. So this populism dominates the moment. Digital dominates the moment, as I said. I'll tell you something else that kind of opened the door to Trump is the drift in the Democratic Party. So I think you're quite right to talk about what's happened to Republicans and how did they become more sort of nationalist and move away from some of the international leadership roles that you had under, say, a Reagan presidency and a Bush presidency. But what happened to the Democratic Party, where the working man, the union member, the factory worker, moved away from the Democrats? How did the Democrats become more new class and more orthodox left and more based on identity politics that is just uninviting to a lot of working class voters, even if there's still sort of an economic orientation to the left? What would give not a billionaire, but a multimillionaire like Trump, who has nothing in common with the working man culturally, what would give him reach with that community that Hillary Clinton didn't have? So it's as much of, I think, an evolution of the Democratic Party as the Republican Party. Now, Biden, to his credit, especially in the last 2 or 3 weeks, if you look at his speeches, he's keyed back into that working class voter a lot more. He talks about he's not an Ivy League college graduate. He went to a state school. So it's a little bit of populism there, a little bit us and them, but it's a shot at Trump. It's a little bit of saying he has a theme about, you know, my dad told me you're no better than anybody else, treat everybody with respect. It's a little bit of sort of Will Rogers egalitarianism, but that'll play well. And again, it's a shot at Trump, who's, you know, sort of the original elitist and original sort of snob. So Biden, I think, gets it that at least culturally, social cultural basis, you've got to be able to speak to this constituency that I feel is cut adrift by traditional Democratic Party. And Republicans can reach out to it.
No, it's an interesting point. And, you know, this is not particular to the US Democrats. We've seen it, I think, with a lot of parties of the center left around the world where, for whatever reason, having a nationalist response to the economic concerns of working class voters and, you know, the parties of the left are not, for whatever reason, connecting with the concerns of those people. But just the Republican Party, you know, if Trump wins, it's going to become the Trump Party, right? Probably in perpetuity, the hostile takeover would be complete. Kind of curious on your take, and you are a never Trumper, I believe. You know, if Trump loses, what happens next for the future of the Republican Party? Some people think it'll double down. You know, you end up with the Donald Trump Jr., you know, as the next proxy for that same nationalist urge, or is the more traditionalist Bush? Bush Republican sort of come back to the center?
Well, you know, I think it's an open question, and a lot of it has to do with personalities as much as the philosophy and the themes, meaning it's not as if there's a working caucus or faction that is a meaningful entity. It's not like Japan where you have LDP factions that stand for something and you group around them and they organize. You can't really have that in the United States, meaning what you have is this running, open debate, argument, fist fight, policy papers, books, talk show kind of behavior until you formally decide this with the primary seasons in 4 years. And you're going to have, you know, it's open casting call, right? There's no playoff bracket where you settle down. Anybody who wants to show up at the starting line for the race could show up at the starting line. So it's a very inviting proposition, and indeed the market tends to overshoot, meaning you tend to get 20 some people showing up saying, I think I'm interested in this job, when you say, well, look, only half of them might really be serious and only a quarter of them I really can go the difference, but there's no filtering mechanism. So I think we're going to have a very open, loud, noisy, maybe at times painful debate on the future of the Republican Party that is only settled during the primary process in 2024. I'll say this, though. I think Trump, if he loses, he still has a shadow, but that shadow lasts 1 or 2 years. And he's got some real strength in that he enjoys the media, he enjoys the public role, and he's a good communicator. So he's got some real strengths. But he has some real disadvantages as well. One is he's not a young man. He's getting into mid-70s himself. And two, I think most importantly, he is defined as a loser. And if you ask what Americans disdain, what they dislike the most, they disdain losers. And I mean, there's not anybody running for public office in America today who says, I better call up Hillary Clinton and get her advice. They say, we'll give her a speaking slot and we'll applaud her and say, oh, respect your long service. But she's deemed a loser. So Trump is deemed a loser. I think right away you lose half the party right that to say, look, your only job was to win this damn thing. You couldn't do it. So why should we listen to you? But there's also true believers. You know, that saying in the U.S., you might have heard it, that both parties are divided functionally between two groups, the priests and the mathematicians. And the priests say, I have the truth, you need to follow me. And the mathematicians say, look, I've got to get to 50% plus one. So the mathematicians move away right away from Trump. Most of the priests, the Trump priests at least, stay with him and say he speaks the truth. But there's different priests. You know, it's a broad church. There's different factions, different denominations. So there'll be other people running in 2024. And one, you could see a series of problems. One is that the Trump field might be the dominant field, but there's no faction mechanism. So what you have are three or four people running as I'm the new Trump. I'm the baby Trump. I'm the mini me, including arguably maybe one of the Trump children running in that capacity. So you have different statewide officials running that way. So you could have four or five people saying, I'm the new adjusted, moderate, improved Donald Trump, right? And then you'll have some people running as non-Trump or anti-Trump. You'll have some people running as fusion candidates. I mean, everybody defines themselves. It's open architecture.
Now, priests and politicians, sorry, priests and mathematicians, that's a fantastic quote that I'm going to be using that. I'm live on air, I'm stealing that quote from you. It's fantastic. Oh, it's really good.
If we're just taking a break, Mike Murphy uses that a lot. So credit him rather than me, at least if you're going to use it independently. Mike uses it all the time.
But Mike's been on the show, so I'm sure he won't mind you borrowing.
Yeah, so to hell with them. Yeah, I agree. I like that.
Mate, I just want to switch gears slightly. Now, you know, you had a big career in U.S. politics. You then went on to be an ambassador. I kind of want to get your take on, you know, U.S. leadership. You know, the U.S. has typically played a big role as a global leader. I mean, how do you see its role presently, and what, you know, what's your take on Trump's approach to the alliance structures that have sort of underpinned the world, you know, post World War II, really, and certainly post the Cold War?
Yeah, and by the way, this process, this evolution, I would say started under Obama, but Trump brings a kind of roughness to it, and Obama had, you know, a lot of charm, I think, in his style, but both of them came to office questioning U.S. international leadership, and both of them, I think, making a lot of similar points that the cost benefit of U.S. role globally was just out of whack, and we needed to trim down and retrench U.S. outreach. That there wasn't an immediate threat, that we sometimes, that global reach sometimes became a self defining mission of we would go on a hunt for enemies and end up in wars where we shouldn't properly be, and the trade policy was, I mean, interesting. Obama ran for president, was the first successful candidate for president to run against trade, and he said almost verbatim the same as Trump, NAFTA is a mistake and NAFTA needs to be renegotiated. Now, to his credit, Obama, when he came into office, backed away from that, and you could say I give him credit for being sort of an economic rationalist, or I give him discredit for being politically expedient. But Trump, I guess you can make the same dichotomy with Trump. To his discredit, he kept his word. But to his credit, he, you know, what he said in the campaign is what he did in office. He said, we're going to try to change NAFTA. So you had the first time in the modern era, from Harry Truman through George W. Bush, 11 presidents in a row, all supporting trade liberalization, U.S. participation in trade. And you have two presidents in a row saying, no, trade's harmful to America. We need to back away from it. But same thing with political military set of issues. You had the sharpest reduction in NATO under Obama that we'd ever had, modern era. And I think Obama's basically saying, look, we're saving money. There's no immediate threat. And Trump, I mean, goes, I think, one click further on the dial. He says, look, I'm not sure I believe in NATO, but I think these other people aren't burden sharing and they're sort of cheating us or abusing a relationship. So we're at a period of definition where the Cold War generation in America has left the scene, or largely left the scene. There's not a consensus on U.S. international leadership role. There's always sort of a populist temptation to argue against playing a role. And I think it's potentially dangerous because, to my mind, if we don't maintain the alliance structure and the international posture we've had, you're going to be inviting to malevolent powers. There's a foreign policy concept known as a provocative weakness. And you've got to be very careful about reducing your posture to a point where you become a provocative weakness and you're provoking instability by not being seen as serious. And I, by the way, I don't think it was any accident that the only change in borders in Europe by force since World War II came with the Russian seizure of Crimea. And that was on Obama's watch, to say, for whatever set of reasons, the Russians, the Soviets always respected U.S. deterrence. They never, they would challenge and provoke and do a lot of things, but the battleground in the Cold War became the Third World, in part because Europe was so stable. So the only place that was left for the Soviets to compete was Central America and Angola and different kind of republics where they could, you know, in some respects compete on an even footing. But Europe was a very stable environment where they knew they should not provoke or challenge NATO. And for whatever set of reasons, Obama didn't have that credibility with the Russians the way other U.S. presidents did.
And so, I mean, you talked about, you know, we've talked a lot about partisanship and we talked about a shift in U.S. Policy in recent times. One of the things that seems quite settled, or at least has a bipartisan consensus about, you know, U.S. competition or strategic competition with China and the Chinese Communist Party. And so I'm kind of curious for your take. You know, you were ambassador to Singapore, you know, you live there now. I mean, how do you see this playing out in that part of the world? It's relevant to Australia as well. I mean, how do you see this contest and how do you see it playing out in the region itself?
I think it's hugely relevant to Australia. Look, I'd make a broad statement that it is, to my mind, China's role in the international system is the foreign policy issue of the moment we're in, of this century, that China is the only major power that is still defining its international role. And it's not entirely up to China itself to define that role, because to the extent its own self-described definition impinges on other people's rights, then they have something to say as well. So, so it's a collective process, but it's an ongoing process. And what we see is, after 30 years of strong economic performance, China's developed a set of political aspirations, and that economic performance is translated into military reach as well. So they're in the game. They're in the competition for power and friends and influence. It's largely peaceful, but not always. And some of it is quite sharp-elbowed. And they don't, you know, always behave in a way that we would say comports with normal diplomatic behavior. So they're you know, playing their own tune and they're marching to their own beat. And the rest of the world is responding to it. Look, a lot of this is okay. A lot of this is within normal parameters. And I think what's important, and where I would fault Trump, I give him marks for calling them out on a lot of their misbehavior, but what he hasn't done is try to shape some kind of positive view on areas where we can cooperate, on some of the trade issues, tourism, educational activity. There's a lot of value, and I would say for Australia as well, to have Chinese students there, Chinese tourists, trade. There's a lot of value in that relationship. So let's try to capture the positive sides of the relationship, and let's be sensitive to the places where there's competition, like in the tech space, like Huawei and so forth, where there's sensitivities and there's ongoing competition. And then at the more serious level, geopolitics, let's make sure we draw a line under a very important geopolitical core interest, like freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, like Taiwan's security, where we make sure we're sending a clear message to China about what U.S. core interests are, and I dare say Australia core interests as well.
But given that we basically now have, you know, the rising economic power is for the first time in a long time is not a democracy. I mean, how do you see the systems competition re-emerging for the first time since the Cold War? And is another Cold War essentially inevitable on that basis?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a Cold War, but I would call it a competition. And China has never, well, not never, but in the last several decades, China hasn't claimed to have global ideological goals. They really abandoned those. In the 1970s, they were funding groups in Africa and Central America. They funded, as we well know, Southeast Asia and Indonesia and Malay insurgency. So they've played a role in guerrilla warfare, but not for 40 or 50 years. I mean, it's been quite a while since they. So what they're acting in some respects closer to, so to speak, normal state behavior. But then you have normal geopolitical rivalry and competition. And the fact, as you observe, the fact that they're Leninist in political structure, I think also is a cause for concern for other countries, that it's not what we would call normal state behavior. But I don't think it's a Cold War competition. I don't think they're trying to get African countries to model themselves after China the way the Soviet Union wanted African countries to adopt Soviet-style government. What they do want from African countries is political support. They want markets. They want Huawei technology embedded in the ecosystem in Africa. So there's certain things they want, but it's more power projection and economic connectivity than sort of political modeling in the strict Soviet sense of that word.
And so, look, getting towards the end here, but I want to just quickly jump back to the US election. Kind of curious for your take. What would your advice be to Republicans that are worried about Trump, that have been lifelong Republicans? What is their role in this election? Do they vote Democrat? They sit it out? And then secondly, would they split ticket? And then secondly, who's going to win? Nail you down to a prediction here.
Well, look, I think there's an aspect of human behavior, regardless of ideology, regardless of policy, there's some aspect of human behavior that any one of us would say this type of behavior is so reprehensible that even if I find myself in agreement with the individual in some respects, I can't in good conscience vote for this person because of his own activity. And that's my feeling toward Donald Trump, though, even though I probably agree with elements of his platform and things he's done, I just don't think he should be president. But I'm giving you a bit of a long answer there because I back into that to say, look, but I'm comfortable with right of center policies elsewhere on the Republican ticket. So I don't have a problem voting for Republican office holders and Republican candidates elsewhere. I know there are some of my colleagues who are never Trumpers who don't adhere to that. And they say not only must we purge Trump, but we must purge anybody who supported Trump and anybody voted with Trump. And so there's got to be a broad, you know, thermidor. We need, you know, Robespierre kind of reaction. I don't subscribe to that. And I'll tell you this, whether Biden wins or loses, if he wins, he's going to want a Republican Senate in there to put a bit of a check on his own left. And he'll be a more successful president if a Republican Senate is in there. And I also think Republicans, if they were looking at a post-Trump Republican Party, Republican Senate will help them develop an identity beyond Trump. And there'll be speakers and leaders politically who are not Donald Trump. So I'm not abashed at all about saying I'm voting. I think I've just applied for my absentee ballot. I vote in Ohio, but I think I've just collected from him, but I think I'll be voting straight Republican for, you know, state and local offices in Ohio. There's always one outlier, one lunatic that you don't feel comfortable voting for, but I'll be voting for, you know, somewhere around 99% to 100% of Republicans, but not Donald Trump.
And the prediction for the presidential race is?
I think Biden wins. I think, Trump's got three big problems, only one of which might have a solution. And three big problems are the economy, coronavirus, and Trump's own personality. Trump has been unpopular, more disliked than liked since he took office. And he can't fix that. That's his operating style. He relishes it. He likes being audacious. He likes playing that public role. He likes being the bad guy. It lets him be the most visible person in the room, but lets him be the most powerful person in the room. So I think he says that's the price I pay for my operating style. So that's just uninviting to people. The coronavirus, I don't see any improvement, any measurable improvement, although Trump will try to message some improvements, but I just don't see that having traction. The one area where Trump can pick up a little bit is the economy is on a bit of an uptick. But he'll get some credit for that. But the main problem with that thesis is it's only on an uptick in a relative sense. In an absolute sense, it's still off peak from coronavirus. So if you ask me how that washes out, it means that people who are inclined to vote for Trump but found all of the last 6 months too tumultuous, they'll gravitate back to Trump. He'll pick up a point or two, right? But people who are disinclined to vote for him aren't going to be won over because we have 2 or 3 months of a nice recovery, because we're still underwater. We're still back below where we were before coronavirus started. So I do think Biden wins. And I'll give you one other prediction, if I might, Misha, that all of this discussion about Election Day anomalies and weird behavior and Trump's weird behavior, well, there's no question at all that he loves being outrageous. He loves being provocative. He loves saying inappropriate things. But I have a feeling this is going to be a reasonably smooth election day, meaning by election night, by midnight election night, U.S. time, we'll know 75% of the results, and we'll be able to make a prediction. Unless the results are, say, less than 2 or 3%, then it's harder to do because it breaks down by states, of course. But if Biden's up there at 3 or 4% lead, where I think he's going to be, I think we'll know, we'll be, you know, congratulating him that night. Although, as I suggested a minute ago, Trump is still of the kind of personality that he'll be defiant, you know, on the bridge of his ship, screaming at the torpedoes. So he still has the capacity to behave in an unstatesmanlike fashion. But I've just got a sense this has a smoother resolution than you might expect, given all the discussion we're hearing today about anomalies on Election Day.
Yeah, a lot of people worried about, the mail-in ballot issue, and then the fact that most, if you look at the messaging and the polling, that Biden's voters are going to vote by mail, Trump's voters are going to vote in person, and then the nightmare scenario is that Trump's in the lead on the night of the election, and then the postal ballots come in over the next few days, and then Trump declares that, it's been stolen from him, right? So that's the nightmare.
Elements of that could happen. I guess what I'm saying is I think 75% of the states that scenario won't apply, that the amount of mail-in ballots are small enough and the lead is large enough, or the counting is taking place quickly enough that even by election night you say, Biden wins Pennsylvania by 400,000 votes. There's still 150,000 votes yet to be counted. And people say, well, that doesn't matter. It's not consequential. So I think that will be about 75% of the states that election night will say it's over. It's done. But that leaves a lot that are closer to your scenario. But I think even in most of those where we say we don't really know, we can't really declare a winner, but we can say if trends continue, this person's won or that person's won, but we can't formally state it. So I think that will be the bulk of, only in a minority of that minority will you say we don't know who's winning and the trends aren't clear either. So we don't really know it. We've just got to keep counting for another few days. But that is going to be a very small number of states where that even sort of materializes. And so I guess I'm prognosticating here that it won't be enough. It won't be big enough states or consequential enough states that it's going to be meaningful, right?
Do you have any concerns about Trump and the Republican Senate in a lame duck session? Trump's lost the election. Biden's not yet been sworn in January. The Republican Senate potentially ramming through Supreme Court nominations or other things of that nature, or is that something that's overblown?
Well, I think they're going to be as forceful as they can. I mean, Andy Warhol once said, Art is whatever you can get away with, but I would say politics is whatever you can get away with. So I would say, yeah, whatever they can sort of legally get away with, and you can criticize their audacity, and you could, take umbrage at their behavior. But to say if the system lets them do this, they're going to do it, or they're going to try to do it. The big, big prize that we're looking at right now is the Supreme Court justice. But I also think we have to give this individual some credit, meaning I think America will more or less accept this process if the person comports themselves with, you know, judicial knowledge and learned behavior and dignity, and the person comes across like a judge, and I think the person will have a big TV audience. I mean, you'll have 50 or 100 million people watching this person's testimony, and they'll come to a conclusion to say the person looks okay to me. So Democrats are against this person only because it's Republican selection. But I think then the issue would just fade. But if the person comes across like a boob, some kind of political hack or not up to the job or otherwise flawed, then I think it raises all of the points you just made to say, look, this is a force. You're using this temporary majority status to push somebody through. And it's going to rank a lot. I think Republicans pay a price for that kind of ham-handedness.
Mm. Well, look, we could talk about this. Clearly, I could talk about this all day, but you've got other things to do. Now, I've got the last question that I don't let any guests leave without getting away. And I know you've been desperately researching Australians, but, barbecue at your place. A barbecue at your place, it could be in Ohio or it can be in Singapore. Singapore is probably not as far for Australians to travel. There's a lot of Aussies in Singapore, but three Aussies at a barbecue at Frank's, and why?
Yeah. The three I'd invite. I've been thinking about this, and I have to ask you a technical question since you're the judge and jury here, but we can also, can we designate pre-Confederation inhabitants as Aussies?
Sure.
Or are you going strictly by, because then I'll say there's an interesting historical figure who has an Australian pedigree, an Australia anchor, but I suspect Australians would deny he's Australian, but he's a fascinating historical figure. And this is your former governor of New South Wales from the colonial era, Captain Bligh.
Right.
I would put William Bligh down as a fascinating individual. This fellow, we in America know him only from Mutiny on the Bounty and the fact that he, has this rather remarkable escape and across several thousand miles of the sea. But I think what few Americans know is then he re-enters the colonial service and he becomes governor of New South Wales. And there's a mutiny again. There's another mutiny against him and he's kicked out again.
Armed rebellion. Yeah.
I would definitely want to ask him, what is there about his management style and his personality that induces people to mutiny against him? And I think, Misha, I'm going to ask you to chip in with me on that. I think what we've got to get him is Dale Carnegie's book about how to win friends and influence people to say, but Captain, you've just got to work on that personality side so you're not rubbing folks the wrong way all day long. But I would put Captain Bligh down there. I thought of somebody else, but I'm not even sure I know their names, but this might be too recondite and not fit under your rules. But I was also intrigued. I was in Perth a few months ago, and I got to go to the Fremantle, there's a shipping museum there.
Yep.
And the exhibit on the Batavia was the Batavia shipwreck. But these were the first Europeans. The two of the mutineers from the Batavia were just set ashore in Australia, and these I'm
Dutch
told
were the company, first, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Dutch, though. It's not even the Brits.
Yep.
So it'd be quite a stretch to call these people Aussies since Australia didn't exist, nothing existed. They were just put ashore as part of their punishment and they disappeared. But it's nonetheless an interesting story. But I'd say back to planet Earth, the real Australia as we know it, I'd say, look, I've always had this curiosity about a prominent Australian who played a signature role in his country's history, but Americans only know him through the prism of World War II, and that's John Curtin.
Yep.
But what's striking to me is that if we look at global leadership at that moment, and I would put Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill and Charles de Gaulle, and I put Mackenzie King in that as well to say these are individuals who we know today as great wartime leaders, and indeed they were. Very important for their nation's survival, but their record domestically and the record in domestic politics was much more mixed, much more ambiguous, and much harder to evaluate. I think as Americans, we're just a bit lazy on this point, but we don't fully understand Curtin's parliamentary pedigree and what his domestic agenda is. And I think because as far as we're concerned, it's just so overwhelmed by war dynamics that we'd say, as far as the U.S. is concerned, it really doesn't matter what he was doing back home. What really matters is the ABCD alliance, you know, in East Asia, and what the Americans, the Aussies, working together. But that would be the fellow. So Captain Bligh and John Curtin. And then I wanted to take a flyer. There's an enormous celebrity culture in Australia, and I wanted to take a bow to it, but to go with someone who might not be terribly well known at the moment, but I suspect will be. And it's a young Australian filmmaker, Natalie James. And she just had a movie out which got released in the U.S. called Relic. And it's a bit of a spooky, a bit of a horror movie. And so she's making a name for herself. I heard her on a podcast, very impressive person. And that's that degree of creativity, entrepreneurial drive, craftsmanship that you really have to respect. And I think when people say what makes Australia great, it's people like that who have a vision and pursue a vision. And so it's not because of celebrity status. I don't think she necessarily has celebrity status, but because she's going down this path of sort of professional excellence and creativity, and she brings joy to our lives with her movies.
Well, I'm going to say, look, I am the judge and jury, and that is without doubt the best answer that we've ever had on this show. The amount of history that you've got on there with William Bligh, the Rum Rebellion, the Dutch East India Company crash in the 17th century in Perth, John Curtin, legendary Labor Prime Minister from World War II, and then a modern-day filmmaker, Natalie James, mate. Five-star effort. Well done.
Thanks, Misha. Am I the only American who didn't say Ned Kelly?
Well, you didn't say Crocodile Dundee or Ned Kelly.
I didn't say Paul Hogan. No,
that's right. So you lost the bingo round, mate, but nevertheless, five-star effort. Look, going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on, and we'll hope to have you on sometime soon.
I'd love to visit with you again. Thank you so much, Misha, for having me on.
Thanks, mate. G'day, Diplomates fans. Thanks for listening to the episode. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this week I'm going to try to do something different. Last episode I said, look, jump on, send me some questions. I'll read them out on air and I'll do my best to answer them. So I've got one that we're going to do on this occasion, and we'll see how we go. So I've got a question from Rebecca, and Rebecca says this: Misha, you talk a lot about the 2016 election getting it wrong. Thank you, Rebecca, for reminding everyone of that. So let's hear it. What's your prediction for 2020? Trump or Biden for victory? So my prediction, and look, thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. I did debate whether or not I wanted to read out this question and answer it on air. however, I'm a man of my word, and I'll bite the mouth guard and I'll give an answer. So drum roll. My prediction is the following: Donald Trump will lose the election and Joe Biden will be president. Look, I get it. It's going to be close, or it looks close, or, you know, a lot of people are concerned about polling. And on the last occasion, Donald Trump was behind and Hillary Clinton was ahead. And we ended up with a surprise Hillary Clinton loss on the night. So a lot of people are doubting polling. I think on this occasion, Donald Trump's the incumbent. He owns everything. He can't run as an outsider. He can't run against his own administration. He can't run against his own record on the economy, the unemployment. He can't run against the chaos that he's created. He can't run against the division. So, you know, running on a law and order ticket works if you're not the incumbent. Biden's got a good lead, or big lead nationally. He's got good leads in all the swing states. I think he'll win and win well. I am concerned about the Russian interference underway and all the kind of crazy things happening on social media. But nevertheless, I think, you know, if you're looking to bet, I reckon Biden might even win states like Florida, Ohio, and maybe Arizona, maybe Texas. So I expect a big Joe Biden victory and a Joe Biden presidency. So there you go, Rebecca. Thanks so much for sending in that question. If you got a question, send it to me on Twitter, private message me on Instagram, whatever you like to do. I'll read it out and I'll answer it. Thanks so much for listening. Jump on iTunes, 5-star reviews. It really, really helps spread the word of the show. If you are a fan of the show, I'm begging you, it does help a lot. Otherwise, I'll see you next week. I'll see you on Twitter. Thanks so much for stopping by, and I'm glad you enjoyed the episode.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show. Or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.